From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. What do you get when you mix widely available high-speed internet access, inexpensive digital devices, open-source software, and easy editing tools? You get what's being called remix culture. For many people, remix culture is the new creativity, and there's a lot of it. YouTube video remixes, mashups, hip-hop sampling. Today's art is about mixing, remixing, and mixing again. Today, we'll talk to some of the world's top remix artists about why and how they do what they do. And we'll explore the 800-pound gorilla that hovers over remix culture. Wait a minute. Isn't all of this illegal?
Calling all parents! Calling all kids!
But first, the unofficial spokesperson for remix culture, Paul Miller. Or as he's better known, DJ Spooky, that subliminal kid. Now, DJ Spooky's much more than a hip-hop DJ. He's a conceptual artist, writer, and musician. His latest book is a collection of essays from artists like Brian Eno, Steve Reich, and Bruce Sterling about the role of sound in digital media. It's called Sound Unbound, Sampling Digital Music and Culture. Steve Paulson spoke with DJ Spooky about the significance of digital media.
A lot of the stuff I tend to find is part of the core of our culture right now is based on kind of our relationship to information, whether it's your credit card or your social security number or the data that's collected as you go from website to website. These things define identity, you know, on a lot of levels. Everything you do is a group of numbers and algorithms resting on some computer someplace. I tend to think that digital media is our new kind of palette. You know, artists, writers, creatives, everybody is dealing with software. So at the heart of it all is collage. Sampling is basically like you take one piece of something and smash it up against something else. And just see what happens.
You say that sound is information. And since we live in the information age, sound is just one more piece of information to be copied and regurgitated and remade.
Cut and paste imagination. I mean, when you think about stuff like Wikipedia, and say, for example, if there's an error in Wikipedia, the average response time to somebody correcting it is about 4 minutes. Just, you know, these are market forces of the idea of free. What happens if you give everything away for free and allow everybody to participate in, you know, just creating anything? Take a Wikipedia page entry, you know, copy it, paste it into a William S. Burroughs novel, take that remix and put it in The New Yorker and you got new fiction or something, you know? The pun for me is that we're looking at new kinds of literacy, digital media, cut and paste imagination, nonlinear thinking, you know, kind of the whole 20th century, you know, McLuhan, the medium is the massage kind of thing. It's just come home to roost.
Here comes the music. Hit me now. Redeem a full of culture, y'all.
There are also legal issues here, and most recorded music is protected by copyright. And I guess I wonder if you ever run into legal problems when you are sampling music.
You know, there's a great quote from Thomas Jefferson, who, of course, helped frame our Constitution and copyright issues. He says, if somebody takes an idea from the light of my candle and lights their candle, it does not diminish my flame, which I think is a great, it's like you're passing the light of information to other people, which is a great way of thinking about copyright in our era of rip, mix, and burn, you know. CDs that anybody can download anything or anybody can rip something and just pass it on to a friend. That's the way we live.
We may live that way, but that's not necessarily what the law says.
Right, but that's what I'm saying. The way the law is written and the way we live are parting ways.
Wait a minute.
So funky. funky. Get boom. So funky. So funky.
Anything once it's recorded is manipulable, whether it's information about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq that were never found, or whether it was, you know, the records of Count Basie and Duke Ellington that people sample really great drum rolls from. The art form is in the edit.
But is that to say there are no new sounds being created anymore? There's nothing new under the sun?
Was there ever? We all hear sounds, and every word we're both speaking is something that we had to learn, and it's part of a vocabulary. Records and sampling are just a different kind of digital literacy. I'm a big fan of saying it's about language, and rhythms are a certain kind of language, beats, styles, guitar riffs. Kids, when they're playing guitar when they're young, guess what? They practice along to their favorite records of Led Zeppelin or Hendrix, learn the riffs, and then they become original. It's just a different kind of play, you know?
So how much is the current remix culture driven by technology, by the hardware and software that's out there?
Oh, my God. If there was an electrical crisis in New York, which there has been, one of the first things to go is electronics. You can hear crickets. You can hear people talking, you know. I kind of dig that. Every once in a while, I go. That's why I went to Antarctica, for example. It was the first time in my adult life I'd been without the web. It was kind of eerie, which was, that's the point. It was withdrawal, you know.
Did you feel slightly unnerved by that?
Yeah, you know, the water is so cold in Antarctica, if you fall in the water, you're dead in 2 minutes. I was more worried about other things.
You didn't have your internet access anymore.
Yeah, saying I'd have to go online to judge how cold the water is, I don't think. But no, it was one of those kind of physical experiences where it made you feel how deeply profound our planet is. I mean, for me at least, going that far away from the urban environment that I'm from and hearing the sounds of the planet itself and just, you know, ice breaking. I mean, I bought a studio down there to record the sound of ice.
So given this information culture that we live in, where sound is everywhere, is there still a place for silence? Can we still have any silence in our world?
I can point you to some spots in Antarctica.
You really have to go that far to find silence?
The world is never silent. I go back to John Cage and a lot of stuff. I have to admit, he's a really big influence. But he went to Harvard. They have what they call an anechoic chamber. You go in and the door closes and you cannot hear anything. Literally, by physics, the walls are made to absorb every sound wave particle. So you're essentially in pure silence. But He said the first thing he heard was the sound of his eyes moving, because your eyes make a little, and it's, I mean, it's just kind of weird squishing sound. And then he realized he heard a weird hum, and that was the sound of his nervous system. And you can actually hear it. You can also hear the blood flowing through your veins. He was trying to get away from sound, but because of the body itself was making sound at every level all the time. So, I don't know, silence. As long as we have bodies and as long as the ears respond to any stimulus or the mind thinks, that's an electrical hum. That's your ears, you know, your nervous system itself is a sound generator. To me, language itself is technology, and it's a kind of an exchange platform. It's the way we speak, the way we build meaning. You could say every song is kind of like a software code or some sort of code that people have written as a poetry of information. I love the fact that we really have to look throughout history for better examples of when new innovation happens.
Well, if we talk about music, for instance, I mean, can we go back, 100 years, and were there mashups back then?
Sure. Jazz. You know, if you were Scott Joplin, you'd borrow a riff from, you know, Box Goldberg variations, mix it with a little bit of New Orleans, and you get, you know, ragtime. Everything is borrowing and, you know, collage. It's just that we now have the formal ability to really think it through and look at where the sample sources are from.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've quoted Emerson, the 19th century writer, who said, it is as difficult to appropriate the thoughts of others as it is to invent. So you're really talking about the art of appropriation, aren't you?
Oh, absolutely. And the Jonathan Lethem essay in my book, it's funny, working with MIT was a great experience. But actually, academic presses move slightly slower than commercial presses. So Jonathan's essay came out in Harper's and was a really big groundswell of support for this idea of plagiarism.
Right.
And his essay is all about plagiarism, but then at the end of the essay, he reveals that everything he's written in the essay was plagiarized from other people's essays about plagiarism. Which, I like the fact you're laughing, and it keeps a sense of humor, and I think things being fun is really important. So, yeah, you're looking at every creative act as a puzzle. You're sorting through to see if it's fun. If it's not fun, just leave it, you know? So, yeah, people, playing records is no different than playing a guitar. It's just that you have to figure out what makes it sound interesting.
New York City, New York.
It's the order of the day from your boss, DJ.
DJ Spooky.
Hopped it from the top to the very last drop.
International.
Swallowed and fought immensely, relentless.
Please tell me you speak.
DJ.
Do you speak a idiot?
DJ.
Do you understand the words that are coming out of my
turntable? Turntable. Turntable.
How can we end confusion? How can we keep things straight? If we could write the words we speak, we could communicate.
DJ Spooky, that subliminal kid, is also known as Paul Miller. His latest book is a collection of essays called Sound Unbound, Sampling Digital Music and Culture. His latest CD is Creation Rebel. Steve Paulson spoke with him. To watch and listen to a sampling of DJ Spooky's multimedia performances, including his ongoing work about the changing climate in the Antarctic, please go to our website at ttbook.org. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
And now, ladies and gentlemen of the radio audience, it gives me a great pleasure.
Good morning, houseplants. Yes, it's wake-up time.
Hey, y'all, wake up.
Time to get up and go to work.
Do you understand what I'm saying? But that can't be.
Lamentations, lamentations, lamentations worldwide.
remix culture takes many forms, but the most popular is the mashup. I sat down with a mashup artist known as the world-famous Audio Hacker to find out just what a mashup is.
A mashup is, I guess in its simplest form, it's basically where someone would take two songs. Usually it's the vocal track or the acapella to one song and basically overlay it on top of the instrumental version of another song, trying to create a new, either a new song or a new interpretation of a maybe more well-known song, something like that. Mm. But then it basically expands past that where, you know, you start playing more tricks and adding more pieces and parts in some cases if you want to make it more complex or whatever.
10 years ago, this wouldn't have been possible. You could have plugged to turntable 20 years ago. 20 years ago, this wouldn't have been possible. You could have plugged two turntables into a mixer and you could have played both at the same time, but you probably couldn't have adjusted the speed so that the beat would match very well, and you'd have a difficult time getting it so that so that it didn't sound completely dissonant. Now you can play with a pitch, you can play with a tempo, you can play with a volume, of course. There must be other things that you can do when you are putting two pieces of music basically against each other, right?
Yeah, well, and I think the point with turntables, too, is that what you could do is you could shift the key of a song and keep it at the same tempo or even slow it down, where with the turntable, you know, that's not even really possible at all. So that's the big difference between, I guess, trying to do something digitally and the turntable or sort of analog or cassette way that you might have seen that 20 years ago or whatever.
You know, with all of the technology, you can do things now that couldn't be done 10 or 20 years ago. But this isn't exactly a new idea, is it? I mean, there always have been references in all kinds of music, in pop music, in rock, in classical, for that matter. You sort of hear references to other kinds of things, but you can play with them in a different way.
Yeah, I mean, I started out as a musician, you know, playing the bass guitar, and I guess when I would write songs, which I don't do much anymore, but at the time when I would, you know, there is this tendency while you're writing something that's similar to how you would compose it with a mashup, which is that you do have a sound or some sort of influence that's hit you that you want to work with, you know, and maybe put your own taste on top of or work with in terms of trying to explore that sound or that method. So in many ways, the difference between me lifting something digitally and looping it and creating a new bass line out of that and me saying, hey, I want to, you know, copy some Beatles bass line and play around like that isn't that much different, you know, from a human behavioral standpoint. So,
Are there any problems with the legality of this? I mean, after all, you are taking other people's stuff. In fact, didn't you just put out a CD box of your mashups?
Yeah, well, it is questionable in terms of the legality of it. Although I think most people who do this, you know, they know that if an artist or a label contacted them and asked them to stop with certain tracks or whatever, that most people would be happy to comply and, you know, take it down. But I've actually had a number of artists ask me if I could do one for them. So it's really interesting.
Yeah.
In that way.
Well, let's take one of your mashups apart so we can see how it works. You brought one for us called Cold Hearted Time Bomb.
Yeah, Cold Hearted Time Bomb. So the opening guitar riff is from The Vines, and the song's called Get Free, which sounds like this. And then I essentially based the track off of Beck's single at the time called Time Bomb. And playing off of Time Bomb, I used a song that was just out at the time as well from The Hives that's called Tick Tick Boom, which sounds a bit like this.
Tick, 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 boom!
And then while I was putting this together, just sometimes things pop in your head and there's really no explanation for it. And there's this guitar riff from an old industrial song by Skinny Puppy called Tin Omen. And I think where I started to stray in this case is, you know, trying to find vocals that worked with everything that we're putting together here, and ended up being Paul Abdul's Cold Hearted.
Uh-oh, he's been telling lies. He's a lover boy at play. He don't play by rules. Uh-oh, girl, don't play the fool. He's a cold-hearted slave.
And I guess when I started having some fun with it, I used a song called Push It by Salt-N-Pepa.
Push it.
And then an old alternative rock song from the 80s by a band called The Godfathers. And the song's called Birth, School, Work, Death. And then finally I used, the rhythm from Young MC's song called Bust a Move, which sounds like this.
So you've got all eight of those very different pieces that you're going to put together into a time bomb. What does it sound like when you do that?
Well, I think to some extent, you know, it is its own creation at that point. But the other thing that I hear when I listen to it is it's if you took the concept of a lengthy DJ mix or something and put it together, in some ways this is that smashed down into 3 minutes, where, you know, in 3 minutes time you get to hear these eight songs pass by and sort of enjoy being, aha, I hear it, there it is, while at the same time not feeling like you have to listen to 40 minutes of music that would cover those eight songs.
Start with one and that's clear, and you add another one and they're still pretty much clear. By the time you put three or four and eventually eight together, none of the originals are really there anymore, are they? It's something entirely different.
Yeah, I think that's a bit of, you know, when you get into the copyright or the legality discussion about this, this is where it starts to be interesting, because you're still obviously doing sampling, which has its own licensing issues already, but you're clearly not just playing, you know, someone's voice on top of a different song. So it does become a new composition, I think.
So all of this put together, do you think mashups are art?
I think they can be. I really do think it depends on what you're doing. I mean, to some extent, you know, is pop music art? I think it can be, and sometimes it's just a disposable moment in time that entertains you well, right? So I think depending on, I guess, the intent of who's doing it and where you go with it, that's the difference between art, so. It's hard to say. I mean, is Andy Warhol art or not? This is sort of Andy Warhol for your ears in some ways, right?
I am a spy in the house of love.
That's Derek Chilcote Bacco, a.k.a. the world-famous audio hacker. To download a free copy of his virtual box set of mashups, go to our website at ttbook.org. Mashups may seem like a modern invention, something really new, but in fact, if you go back a century to, say, the American composer Charles Ives, you'll find something of the same sort. He wanted to create something for the 4th of July, taking not just the patriotic music of the day, but the sounds as well, the marching bands, the fireworks, the drum corps, baseball. So he put it all in his head and mashed it up. There's a piece of music called The Fourth of July, which has recognizable tunes in it. Columbia, the Gem of the Ocean, the Battle Hymn of the Republic, the Battle Cry of Freedom, and Yankee Doodle. Ives wrote about the piece, well, I did what I wanted to, quite sure that the thing would never be played, perhaps could never be played. But it was. The Fourth of July premiered in Paris in 1932, performed by the Paris Symphony Orchestra, and it is arguable that that could be the first ever mashup.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear listeners. Happy birthday to you.
That's our producer, Charles Monroe Kane, singing. Singing? Happy birthday to you. Terrible singing voice, yeah. But even worse, what he did was against the law. See, Happy Birthday to You is copyrighted, and that copyright is rigorously enforced by its owner, Warner Chappell, a division of Time Warner. You can sing it at home, but in a ballpark or a restaurant or on the radio, it is against the law unless you get permission first. And if you sing the song for commercial or broadcast use, well, then you have to pay royalties as well. Lawrence Lessig thinks this is absurd. He's a law professor at Stanford and one of the leading advocates to change copyright law. He's coined the term remix culture, referring to mashup artists and hip-hop samplers who routinely violate copyright infringement and thus break the law. Steve Paulson caught up with Lessig to talk about remix culture.
Forget music or film for a second. Think just about writing. Nobody thinks when you sit down and write an essay about Hemingway, even quoting works from Hemingway that might still be in copyright, that you've got to contact the Hemingway estate to get permission to quote that work inside of your own work. Everybody understands the freedom to include and to quote is part of the freedom of a society that believes in free expression and creativity. Now, I think what's happening in the context of remix culture is essentially that freedom carried over from text into the space of video and music, because for the first time, technology has democratized those forms of expression in exactly the way the pen or the typewriter democratized writing.
Isn't the crucial question how much you copy, or going back to the writing example, how much you quote?
Well, it's not the crucial question from the perspective of the copyright extremists as they exist right now. They believe any quoting requires permission. There was one case that went to a court of appeals where the basic position was even one note from a recording sampled by a remixer would require permission of the copyright owner. So there's no equivalent conceded by the extremists. They think permission is required for everything. And I think those, you know, from the tradition I'm talking about say that there's a certain balance that has to be permitted if we're going to allow creativity of the past to continue in the future.
Now, on the other hand, there are a lot of hip-hop musicians and mashup artists who don't care at all whether it's legal or not. There's at least one mashup artist who said theft is good for art.
Yeah, I think that people from that perspective are actually buying into the framework of the copyright extremists. You know, when people like Girl Talk or a DJ Danger Mouse make the work that they do, I don't think they're stealing. It's the wrong word. It's not at all what happens, any more than I think that I'm stealing when I quote from Martin Luther King in a lecture I give to my students. What I'm doing is incorporating parts of my culture in a new creative work for the purpose of either criticizing or extending or celebrating or just making reference to the culture around us. That's a kind of freedom we have always had. And I think what's lost in this debate is that this is not a struggle about, you know, new opportunities for people to steal. What's happening here is we're engaged in a battle over new opportunities to control how people speak and create. Never in the history of copyright has copyright tried to exercise such extraordinary control over people's use of culture. This is the first time in our history where the law is purported to regulate absolutely everything a kid does in the creative work under the name of copyright. That's the radical change that's gone on here.
And yet, from the perspective of people in the movie industry and the music industry, there seems to be a whole generation of people out there right now who are breaking the law.
Yeah, that's exactly their perspective. And technically, they're right. According to the way the law's been incorporated, an extraordinary range of how people use computers is now deemed to be illegal. Now, I think this is the real problem. You know, it's like, you know, a war of prohibition that we're engaged in here. And we've told a whole generation that they are criminals, they're pirates, they're felons, according to our law. Now, you know, when you tell a generation that they're criminals, they begin to listen to that. They begin to think to themselves, oh, you know, we're criminals. And that attitude begins to erode their respect for the law in all sorts of other contexts as well. So, you know, we're waging this war against our children, a war my friend, the late Jack Valenti, referred to as his own terrorist war, where apparently the terrorists are our children. And what that war is doing is turning our children into the very criminals that we accuse them of being. But it's not just copyright that's going to suffer here. It's the whole society that begins to be raised under the attitude that the law is something that you don't respect.
Play that out for me a little bit. What do you worry about in terms of how far this might go regarding how young people would break the law?
Well, I think that it's essential, and this is the way, you know, the law has thought about its role for the last 300 years. It's essential that when the law tries to regulate, people buy into the regulation. People, in some sense, believe in it. You know, so, of course, there are thieves and there are murderers and there are rapists out there, but most of us believe that the rules there are sensible and we respect them and we actually help to enforce them. When the law tries to reach too far, as it did with prohibition of alcohol, it begins to erode society's respect for the law generally, and it begins to breed a kind of corruption inside of society in all sorts of other contexts. I mean, the greatest problems from prohibition had nothing to do with alcohol. They had to do with the fact that huge swaths of the government became corrupted by the system, and people, you know, worked celebrating the lives of criminals as opposed to celebrating respect for the law. I'm worried that's the same thing that's happening here in our war of prohibition against our kids' use of culture.
Now, you've said that copyright law squelches creativity. Can you give some specific examples of this?
Well, you know, let's be very clear. There are copyright abolitionists out there, people who want to eliminate copyright law. I'm not one of those people. I think copyright law is essential, even in a digital age. But I think that it's radically over-regulating right now. It's regulating all sorts of things that makes no sense for it to be regulating. So one place it's regulating unnecessarily is in the context of remix culture. Now, for example, you can distinguish between professional remixes, you know, the work of Girl Talk or the work of even DJ Spooky or DJ Danger Mouse. You know, let's put that to the side for one second. Let's just focus on amateur remixes. Kid takes a movie like The Matrix, re-edits the trailer, sets it to a music track, and puts it up on YouTube for other kids to share for totally non-commercial reasons. This act of creativity is deemed to be a crime right now. And so if the owners of the Matrix franchise come and say, take that down, YouTube's got to take it down. This kid is a copyright infringer for that act of creativity. Now, I think there is no reason in the world why the law should care about regulating that type of creative activity. Yet it does right now. And what that means is when high schools or colleges think about creating educational programs that try to teach kids how to do this remix, the lawyers come to them and say, you know, you can't do that. You can't teach kids how to do that kind of stuff because that stuff is deemed illegal and we're not going to be encouraging illegal activity here on our campuses. So it not only tells the kid that the kid's a criminal, and of course, you know, most kids would just ignore that. What it does, though, more importantly, is it stifles institutions that should be encouraging this kind of creative expression by telling them that the creativity is illegal, and so therefore they ignore it. And they, you know, tell kids that they should write essays about Hemingway that quote Hemingway and Fitzgerald without, you know, thought about the copyright issues, but they can't make a movie or remix a movie because Hollywood says that that act of creativity is a crime.
Now, you've done something pretty interesting yourself. Your latest book, Code Version 2.0, is actually available free by download under a particular license. Can you explain this?
Yeah, actually now all of my books are available under Creative Commons licenses. The basic license that governs all of them except Code Version 2 says you can download it and share it or remix it or make a derivative from it as long as you're doing it for non-commercial purposes. If you've got a commercial purpose, come talk to me and we'll talk about it. But anything beyond commercial purpose, you're free to do with it. Code Version 2 is actually one step beyond that. That says you can download it and do anything you want with it. If you make a change or a derivative, you just have to release that as freely as you received yours. So in principle, somebody can take Code Version 2 and start publishing it and selling it and not give me a penny. As long as they don't make any changes, they're free to do all of that consistent with the license that governs it. So it's not just that you can get it for free, it's that it's been licensed in a way that guarantees certain freedoms attached to it.
Let's suppose your vision were to come to happen, that there would be some kind of Creative Commons that that all kinds of musicians and writers and film producers would use, and the copyright laws would be dramatically changed. How would our culture change as well, do you think?
I think what we're seeing is a return to a picture of culture that actually was very much the culture of the 19th century and before. I talk about this extraordinary testimony of John Philip Sousa, where Sousa goes to Congress in 1906 to complain about the talking machines. But in the course of this testimony, he says, when I was a young man, in the summer evenings, the young people would get together and sing the songs of the day or the old songs. Today, you just hear these infernal machines going night and day. We'll not have a vocal cord left, Sousa said. The vocal cords will be eliminated by a process of evolution, as was the tale of man when he came from the ape. Now, Sousa in that passage, you know, here a professional musician is celebrating the amateur. What he's talking about is the extraordinary importance of young people getting together and singing the songs of the day or the old songs, right? And he's worried that's going to disappear. But that's exactly what has reappeared because of the internet. What we've seen is a culture not so keen in couch potato-like manner to sit there consuming culture produced professionally by others. They're, of course, interested in that professional culture, but they want to do something with it. They want to sing the songs of the day or the old songs. They want to share that singing. But singing now is not using vocal cords. Singing is using digital technologies, remixing, doing different kind of adaptations, and then sharing that with all sorts of their friends. I mean, go to YouTube. YouTube has these extraordinary communities of people taking a particular song, doing a version of it, and then remixing it and sharing it back with each other, usually in a kind of mashup. So there's these great series of mashups, first with Superman as the cartoon, and then with Simpsons as the cartoon, then with Disney as the cartoon. In each of these cases, what the kids are doing is that they're basically taking the culture, remixing it, and sharing it in exactly the way that Sousa was celebrating. And I think that's where we could get again. We could get to a place where people are not just passive consumers, they are creators.
That's Stanford Law Professor Lawrence Lessig in his office in Los Angeles. Steve Paulson spoke with him. Lessig's the founder of Creative Commons. His book, Code Version 2.0, is available for free at our website under a Creative Commons licensing agreement. Just go to ttbook.org. And while you're there, you can also legally rewrite his book, remix it, and even distribute it if you want.
You've read many stories about many different magazine heroes, but there's never been a story like this one, because there's never been a hero like Spider-Man.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. This hour, we're talking about remix culture, audio hacking, mashups, hip-hop sampling. But before all that, before the iPod, before the internet, remix culture was alive and well, and it was called a mixtape. That's tape like cassette tape, remember? Jason Bittner remembers. He's the editor of a website called cassettefrommyex.com. It's a website that shares the stories and the soundtracks to your earliest loves. And Strange Chimps asked Bittner where the idea came from.
This all started a few months back when I was going through some boxes in my basement, and I realized that I have just 3 tapes left, you know, from my teenage years, and none of them were retail. None of them were store-bought tapes. They were all mixtapes, like ones that people who were interested in me had made for me. And it occurred to me, you know, there's got to be something here. Like, why did these tapes stick with me for the past 16 or 18 years? And it just kind of dawned on me that it's because they're special. You know, they carry a lot of meaning and a lot of weight and a lot of nostalgia. So, you know, going back and putting this into my cassette player, all of these memories started flooding back, you know, listening to these tapes when I first got them, driving around in my car. And it dawned on me that if I have one of these tapes, there's probably a lot of people who've managed to hold on to these tapes for, you know, decades.
Well, tell us about some of the submissions your website has gotten. People have sent you in mixtapes and told you stories about them. You brought a few in, right?
Yeah, we have a few different ones here. I like this one from Dave Nadelberg. He kind of tells us the story about how he'd never received a mixtape to date. You know, he'd always been making them for other people, but he himself had never received one from someone. So he starts off, "We were at a rave in Ithaca, New York. I was drunkish. She was stonedish. Despite our inebriated vision, it was lust at first sightish. This was the start of my relationship with Amy, a short-lived affair that, from that moment on, was defined by music. Not surprisingly, during one of our first sober conversations, Amy and I discussed our mutual love of making mixtapes. A few weeks later, Amy handed me a decorative yellow cassette. It even had a title, Obliteration, the spine read. Obliteration was to be the soundtrack of our relationship."
I take it the relationship didn't go too well.
He goes on, "Truth be told, as much as I appreciated it, the tape seemed thrown together, kind of like two strangers making out on a dance floor." And he goes on to say, "I had to face the music. It wasn't meant to be."
There's one song on that tape, Saturday Night.
Yeah, again, that was an Atomic Dustbin song. And that, for me, that sort of captures the energy and the spirit from where Dave had met the woman who made him the mixtape. It's kind of a classic early 90s party jam.
S-A-T-U-R-D-A-Y-R-Lies. S-A-T-U-R-D-A-Y-R-Lies.
if Dave's mixtape was kind of a failed love letter, tell me a story about a love letter that, or a love mixtape that really works.
Well, there's one in particular. Jamie Hayes was growing up outside of St. Louis, and she received this very sweet cassette. I guess it's best spoken in her words. She says, "My boyfriend delivered it along with breakfast in bed on the morning of my 20th birthday, hence the title, Good Morning, You're 20. In the mix, you can hear the excitement and enthusiasm in the tape of being young, newly in love with each other, and in love with music. While the relationship didn't last, the tape did, staying in heavy rotation all the way until last year when I finally got an iPod."
What music is on her tape?
This one's great. This one has a lot of soul and funk and a little bit of reggae. But there's one song that starts off side A. It's Soul Brothers 6, Some Kind of Wonderful.
I don't need a whole lot of money. I don't need a big fine car. I got everything that a man wants. I got more than I could ask for.
Picturing a 20-year-old getting that song from her boyfriend on her birthday. It's just, oh, it's kind of like a love letter that you save and reread every few years so you can always remember what it felt like to be loved like that.
Absolutely. There's a lot of nostalgia and a lot of sweetness on this tape, kind of contrary to the one that we were just listening to from Dave Nadelberg. This one, it just has like just this real sweetness and enthusiasm that goes with really just loving one another in a real kind of simple and young kind of a way.
Mm. Of course, when you're young in those years, love can also be filled with anguish and, you know, sorrow. One of my favorite stories on your website is from Fiona Maisel.
Yes. This one has the end of the relationship. Fiona tells us a story about being in a relationship for about a year and then her parents telling her that the situation is changing. She says, "In May of that year, my parents announced that we were moving to Los Angeles. I had a party in our apartment a couple of months before, which sent one kid to the hospital with kidney failure, so there was no trusting me to stay behind and finish out high school in New York. Me and John were doomed. I didn't take it well. He took it worse. I was going to California. The first guy who ever loved me was not. He made me a mixtape."
Shall I assume he put Going to California on the mixtape?
Side A, first song, Led Zeppelin, Going to California. It was perfect.
Spend my days with a woman unkind, smoke myself and drink all through my life. Made up my mind, make a new start, going to California with an aching in my heart. Someone told me there's a girl out there with love in her eyes and flowers in her hair.
This one has just a ton of really great loaded songs also. Towards the end of side B, you start getting into some Guns N' Roses, Patience, and then you get to Dire Straits, So Far Away, and the final song on the end of side B, The Doors, The End.
Oh, you kind of get the feeling that Fiona and her boyfriend maybe were sort of relishing that feeling of love and longing and, you know, true love.
I imagine they were. And, you know, it's this mixtape just really encapsulates, like, that moment, you know? This is a tape that was intended to be listened to in the car when she's heading, you know, the 3,000 miles from New York all the way to the West Coast. You could just picture her in her cassette, you know, somewhere outside of Omaha, just sitting with the emotion that's kind of throughout the tape.
Right. trapped in her car with her horrible parents with her headphones on, just dreaming of her boyfriend back home.
Exactly.
Yeah. And it's funny, although Fiona doesn't really tell us much about the boyfriend. You know, I think we know his name is John, and that's about it. You hear that song, and you really get a picture of this teenage guy who's dreaming of his girl in California. I guess it makes me realize that what an intimate thing making a mixtape can be. This is the end.
It's true, you know, it really, in this case, song selection was spot on, you know, he really nailed it. And it sounds like he really sent the message he was intending, you know, there's a lot of wistfulness, a lot of heartache, and sort of the sense of inevitable doom. You know, cross-country relationships when you're in high school generally don't work out for the best.
I'll never look into your eyes again. Can you picture what will be so limitless and free? Desperately in need of some stranger's hand. It
Jason Bittner's website is called cassettefrommyex.com. Anne Strange Chance spoke with him. If you'd like to share your story and mixed cassette tape from an ex-girlfriend or ex-boyfriend, please go to our website at ttbook.org. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast. You can buy a copy of this program by calling a radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for Remix Culture, program number 720A. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Charles Monroe Kane, with the help of Veronica Rickert, Doug Gordon, Anne Strange Champs, and Mary Lou Finnegan. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.